Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of a day for the 13th of Iyar. We start today with gratitude to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Bromwich, to David Hachhauser for putting the shiurim online, and today we're going to get to the Stitz Eliezer on three topics. The longest one is a topic that I think will appreciate his perspective. The second one is where he'll be a little bit, I think, more medically and religiously conservative than many of us would like, which doesn't change the fact that he's a Tzitz Eliezer and we're not. And then the third is a topic that he's the most famous, I think, of the tshuvot that he's ever published. The one that when I used to mention to people I'm dealing with the Tzitz Eliezer, they would say, oh, isn't he the one who paskens? So we'll get to that later. So this is from volume 15, response number 13. And the original question was the question number one that takes up most of the time of the tshuva, of the responsum, is when a doctor finds information that's problematic, meaning that he has reason to believe that the person, that is the patient, is going to cause trouble for others. So in the context of psychiatry, you can imagine that the doctor, the therapist, comes to understand the patient intends harm to others. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about an eye doctor. So we're talking about an eye doctor, and this is a responsum that he sent on the 13th of Iyar of Tufshin Mem Aleph of 1981. He's about 66 years old. He sends a responsum to Dr. Ephraim Avraham, who's an eye doctor in Bnei Brak, and he says, I got your letter. Your letter came on the 25th of Nisan, so that's already 2.5 weeks before. He says, but I was in the hospital at the time. I don't know why, but apparently he was in the hospital, and therefore I didn't get to it until just now, and he apologizes for that. So the question was, a doctor is examining a patient, and he finds that the patient has eye problems. So some examples that Tzitz Eliezer gives are the Shdei Ri'iyah, the field of vision, Ri'iyat Laila, night vision, O Biri'at Tzva'im, or color blindness. Shdei Ri'iyah, I think, means field of vision, but it might mean strength of vision, or it might be that I just skipped it. There's a... I cut out pieces of these tshuvot to make them more presentable in a shorter period of time so that we don't have to always, and even then I have to pick tshuvot that are also at a certain length. But so whatever, the eye problems are sufficient, they cause a significant problem. Now, when it comes to color blindness, I probably would have never thought that color blindness creates actual problems in terms of vision that are important to people in any way. But without any spoiler alerts, I would just point out that it is an issue in the movie Little Miss Sunshine, which is just a funny movie. No reason to see it necessarily. It doesn't have any deep meaning of life issues in it. It might have a few in any case. But color blindness, without spoiling anything, does come up there at some point at a juncture in the movie. So here too, it could be the color blindness an issue, and the doctor understands and believes that whatever eye problems, whatever vision problems this patient has could cause accidents. In driving, that's the easiest one that we think of. Right, so color blindness, I guess, if you don't see a red light because you think it's really a green light, you don't notice the difference in red and green, you can go into an intersection and cause an accident. But then also, avodah b'tasiyah, if a person works in industry, in manufacturing, so on the manufacturing floor, if you can't see things, or you don't see well or this, or in medical, not medical, in military service. Right, so all those are situations, and there are probably more, that eyesight is vitally important. So the person, the patient, doesn't want to stop doing what he's doing, right? You can easily have this with elderly people who, they're 80s, 90s, and their eyesight is going, so they can't see very well, but they don't want to stop driving because it's such a thing to their, it's such a strike at their independence that they don't want to have to give it up. That's an example. Another example, you can easily imagine somebody who's going to the military and has eye problems, and those will not let him or her get into the unit that they want to get into. So they say, no, just don't reveal it. I'll get away with it. So is the doctor required to, there's a Hippocratic oath, there's patient-doctor confidentiality, are you required to maintain that confidentiality, maintain that secret, or... Now, you could have imagined the other option would be, or are you allowed to inform the authorities? So the question, though, is, or are you perhaps required to inform the authorities? These authorities would be the Office of the Ministry of Transportation, which deals with, in America, would be the Department of Motor Vehicles. In Israel, it's the Misrad HaTachbura, the Ministry of Transportation, or the military, or the employer. Especially if you think about an employer, employer's going to be on the hook if this employee causes some accident or the accident could, first of all, cost the employer huge amounts of money, or the employer could be liable for things that the employee does, right? Imagine if you have an Uber driver, and they're just consultants, but imagine you have a taxi company that employs people. If one of their drivers causes an accident, you can easily imagine somebody suing the company itself. So is the doctor allowed, required, or prohibited from revealing the information to relevant parties? And this is with the understanding that this information nonetheless might cost might create some cost, social or financial, to the person who is ill, to the patient. And so let's say the patient says, that's one standard. Do you have to tell? Let's say the patient says, please don't tell, and I promise not to. So an easy example would be not to drive, right? I promise at work, if it was a work issue, I promise at work to find other duties. But let's I promise not to drive. An elderly person says, Doc, you know what? I don't want to lose my independence. I don't have to give up my car. But I promise I won't drive it. I just want to keep it because it's psychologically important to me to keep it. So is the doctor, but the doctor's not convinced. If the doctor's convinced, you could argue that he would just keep the secret. So what if the doctor's not convinced that he can trust the person to keep to this commitment? So his answer is for sure that the doctor is required to inform the relevant authorities and to the employer as long as he's not convinced that the person won't live up to his agreement. Meaning if you trust the person, there's no reason, then it's really just lashon hara because you're transferring information about a person that's not relevant to other people. But when it's relevant to other people, that's different as we're going to see in the continuation of the tshuva. And he says in Velomi Baya, it's not required, you don't need it to be the case that they summon you to give testimony. Meaning, let's suppose somebody could renew their license and they don't need a doctor's note. They just need to say, I saw a doctor. Or they'll say, I saw the doctor. Right, that's it. They don't need a doctor's note. They don't need a doctor's complicit. So the Tzitzit says, that's not enough. The fact that the person get their license renewed without you, but you know they shouldn't be driving anymore, or the renewal, the license isn't up for 3 more years, so they're not going to call you for 3 more years, doesn't matter. It's not allowed. You're not allowed to keep quiet about it. You have to inform the relevant people who might be affected by the situation. You have to inform them. And the oath that doctors take is a general oath to keep the confidentiality of the patient. That's not in this situation. Because in this situation, it's Hava Kenishba Levatil Et HaMitzvah. If you think that the oath applies to that as well, so one argument would have been to say the oath never meant to include that. When people take the Hippocratic Oath or the Maimonidean version of the Hippocratic Oath, if they're observant doctors, so they can affirm they're going to maintain the confidentiality of the patients, that either isn't meant to apply where the patient's health information really is relevant to other people in a way that's important to them, or even if it is, then this would be nishba levatel a mitzvah. It's like taking an oath to agree not to perform a mitzvah. And we can't take oaths. When I say can't, it's not that we're not allowed to. It's that halakhically we don't think they take effect. That if somebody is, or we believe that all Jews have already taken an oath at Sinai to fulfill the Torah, so any time that some later oath that we take would be an oath to not keep the Torah, that oath doesn't take effect. So here too, it wouldn't take effect because you're causing danger to other people, either financial or physical, especially physical, but even financial. So, and not only that, he says to Tzitzit that if the doctor doesn't let the information be known, he is violating the prohibition. This is why the oath wouldn't take effect, because it's a prohibition of lo tamod al dam re'acha. Lo tamod al dam re'acha literally means don't stand by and watch your brother's blood being spilt. So that's an obligation min haTorah of pikuach nefesh, but the Tzitzit Ezer is pointing out that we assume in halacha that that doesn't only apply to the danger of death. So it's not only that the driver is so dangerous he might cause an accident that will kill people, but even if it's a financial situation, there's room there to believe also that you're supposed to not stand by and watch it, as he's about to say. He says, because nothing gets within pikuach nefesh, if you know it's going to save lives, you have to do it. So that's interesting, because the Tzitzit is now assuming, I'm not disagreeing with him, I'm just saying, he's pointing out that saving lives includes, if I know that somebody will cause a life-threatening danger sometime in the future, and I have no idea when in the future, it is still considered pikuach nefesh to, if I have a way to stop that from happening. Not that Tzitzit Ezer talks about it here, but that complicates the whole question of pikuach nefesh in lots and lots of ways that people don't always think about. There might be many more things that are considered pikuach nefesh than we think about because of how far down the road you have to look before you consider it pikuach nefesh or not pikuach nefesh. Good, important question of its own. Comes up in other contexts, let's say, question of its own to think about. But here, for sure, Tzitzit Ezer is confident that it qualifies to pikuach nefesh, and he thinks that that's true about financial issues as well. He says, "Nezek kalkali o chevrati lachole." I'm sorry, the financial or social loss for the patient doesn't outweigh the pikuach nefesh. But it's clear that lo tamod al dam re'acha here applies to financial loss as well. I'm not seeing it right now, but we're going to come across it. I'm confident that he means that, because his point is not only if the patient is going to cause the mortal danger to other people, but even if it's just a financial issue. So now he's going to point in other sources that will talk about this idea that people have. People have the idea you shouldn't talk about other people, you shouldn't reveal the negative information. So he says, I want to point out, I saw a sefer called Pitchei Tshuva Narachaim in Simon Kuf Nun Vav, and who writes there, V'ra'iti lahazkir po, asher kol ha-sifrei musar hir ishu alavon lashon hara. Right, you read, open a Musar book, you open a book of ethical Jewish literature telling us how to be better Jews, how to be better people, and one of the things they always talk about is Lashon Hara, right? Chafetz Chaim is well known for having been so upset about Lashon Hara, worried about Lashon Hara, so this book, Pitchei Tshuva on Narach Chaim, which I think is a 19th century volume by Yisrael Isserlein of Vilna, but I didn't find so much information about him, other than I think he lived from 1827 to 1889. In any case, this Rav Yisrael, this Pitchei Tshuva, says that you look in the Musar books, you find them all talking about Lashon Hara, and I think, he says, that another, a more important sin, a more significant sin, and which I think is more commonly found, is that people refrain from telling certain things, which would save people from getting lost in various situations and getting into trouble. So for Derech Mashal, he gives an example. If you see somebody who's planning on doing evil to another person, or somebody like breaking into somebody's house, so you would certainly tell them, right? And you wouldn't say Lashon Hara. And if you didn't tell them because of the Lashon Hara, you say, oh, Lashon Hara is talking about that person, then it would be a terrible sin, right? You're violating Lo Tamod Adam Re'acha. That's an example of where Lo Tamod, don't stand by while your brother's blood is spilled, applies to financial things, not just to physical things. V'chein b'yen mamod hu b'chlal ha-shavat aveidah. So it might be Lo Tamod, it might be ha-shavat aveidah. Ha-shavat aveidah might mean not just that you see that somebody's property is lost, but you see that a loss is coming to them, and it's part of ha-shavat aveidah, returning lost items, that you tell them ahead of time that it's going to happen to them. So he adds, v'chein b'inyanei shiduch. And so too, when people are thinking about getting engaged to each other, somebody calls you up and says, you know, what do you think of so-and-so for my son, daughter, right? So the instinct might be to say, well, I don't want to get in the way of anybody's shidduch, but this Pitchei Tshuva on Orach Chaim is pointing out, what are you talking about? That's a person's life you're talking about. Unless if you know relevant information that might say that this isn't the right shidduch for you, and you don't tell them who you're dealing with, you know that the prospective chatan is a terrible person, or the family are terrible, or some problem with them. Kolel bichlal hashavat avedat gufo b'mano. It's part of hashavas aved. It's part of making sure they don't have lost objects, that including their lives and their time spent in their life and with the person they spend it with. So this is a crucial issue. It comes up a lot of things. Imagine if somebody's going to business, think about going to business with somebody else, and you know information about one of the prospective partners that isn't known. So you have to tell. And the reason you have to tell is, and you say, oh, it's Lashon Hara. It's not Lashon Hara because it's important for them to know it, so it's relevant. All right? So relevant information to protect somebody from loss doesn't count as Lashon Hara. So too, coming back to the doctor, relevant information to prevent other people from loss, financial or physical, is not Lashon Hara, and it's not something we're allowed to ignore and leave unsaid, and therefore we have to say it. And I know of sad situations where people get stuck in things because nobody stopped and said to them ahead of time, listen, you know, you got to know this person has this issue, whatever it is. So you could say, well, if you tell them and they decide to go ahead with it anyway, that's their problem. But if you don't tell them, then they didn't know, and then they were allowed to be entrapped in a situation that wasn't of their doing. These others, I think these are important words, and they support what he had said as well, as long as you're very careful that the whole point and the whole purpose is to help the person out who might have loss and to help the society out. And then you're fulfilling a great mitzvah. He says, I also found the situation in a Shut Kelkat Yaakov, who was a Rav before World War II in Poland and Germany, and after World War II in Switzerland, and apparently an important Rav. He's in my Bar Ilan, if that's a marker of importance, is being quoted by Tzitzit Eliezer, if that's a marker of importance. So he was asked a situation, and again, I'm not getting to the medical practices here, it's a reminder of a different time. You had a young man who sadly had terminal cancer, or he had cancer. I don't know if they know that it's terminal, or they think it's terminal, it's not clear, but he doesn't know, the patient doesn't know. Right, this is another time when you wouldn't necessarily, doctors didn't necessarily feel that they always told the family things, so, or the patient things. I think that's why I think it's terminal, because if it wasn't terminal, you'd tell them how to treat it and what to do with it. In any case, the family doesn't know and the patient doesn't know. And now he's sadly a young man, he got engaged. Right? If you don't know that you're terminally ill or if you're seriously ill, you get engaged. So it's not, in other situations you can say, oh, well, if the person's hiding the information, then it's my job to step in and help them out. But Rav Chelkat Yaakov says that he was asked about the doctor. Does the doctor have to tell this young woman that she should know that, oh yeah, I'm sorry, he is terminal, I forgot. Does she need to know that the doctors think he doesn't have more than a year or two? So, and then in the tshuva, in the request, it says very clearly, which is also an interesting perspective. I don't know today if the next sentence would be true, and I'm saying it should be true. I'm just saying these were the facts back then. And it's clear that if you tell her this, she's not going to get married to him, because why would she get in herself a situation where she spend a year or two with this man, develop emotional feelings, develop a connection, and then have him die, right? So, and then she'll need a chalitza. It's all broch, right? It's a whole bad situation. So the assumption was that if she finds out, she won't get married. So the Kalkas Yaakov answers, yes, you're required to tell the young woman, because otherwise you're violating lo tamar adam riecha. So here it's clearly a financial or emotional experience, not just the, not a, a, an actual danger of death. So we apply lo tamar adam riecha, or as the Israel said, you could apply perhaps hashavat aveidah. So that was another example of this, and he quotes the Rambam. The Rambam in Perek Aleph Hilchos Ritzeach says, and it's in the Shulchan Aruch as well, that if somebody sees somebody else drowning, or there's a wild animal coming and threatening a person, or you hear, the example is non-Jews, but don't only be non-Jews. Let's assume that only non-Jews would do such a thing, planning some kind of evil to the person. They're going to swindle him, they're going to cheat him, they're going to, you know, they're going to buy him out of the business when they know that they are about to make, you know, $1 billion off of the business, and you don't reveal it to the Jew in question, that's all a violation of lo ta'amod. And so Chalki Yaakov said, and it's all the more so in our situation. Therefore, Chalki Yaakov said, all the more for his situation, and it says in our situation as well. And therefore, you have to tell the doctor, the eye doctor, come back to the situation that Tzitzit Ezra was discussed with, the eye doctor, you have to tell about the limitations of this chole, this person who now has eye issues. So that's the first and central part of the tshuva, that Tzitzit Ezra wants us to realize that when there's information we have, even if it's given to us in confidence, even if the person who gave us the information wants it to be maintained as a secret, if it affects other people and is information that can help them avoid danger or loss, we are required to share it with them. That's true of the eye situation, where the person can cause danger to others or financial loss to others. It's true, as we've seen, of any information where it's bad information about a person but will help others know who to get involved with or not to get involved. And even if it's not information that's negative about the person, such as they have a terrible illness, even that is information that must be shared with a prospective spouse, because they need to know before they get married what they're getting themselves into. The assumption of the tshuva and the Chalkat Yaakov was the person would definitely not get married if they know. Even today, I'm not sure that's true. I don't think it should be true, but it's certainly true that the person should have the right to know and have the right to make an informed decision about these things. So that is the first step. Lashon Hara is not where the information we're giving to people has importance for them in terms of their lives, in terms of what they need to do or to react and how to be involved in that situation. That it's not Lashon Hara anymore, and I think that's a crucial, I think it's a crucial thing to understand, as if it's Ezra needed me to agree. So he is quoting people to point out that yes, the information must be told, it must be not just if it's solicited, it must be volunteered to make sure that people don't get into the situations. Second question the tshuva was about, not the same issue, but let's suppose you have another case, a different case, but having to do with eyes, because it's an eye doctor. Let's suppose you do an eye transplant. So eye transplants are, you can take eyes out of people who have passed away, especially with brain death, but I'm not sure. So I just looked it up. Eye transplantation is generally really a reference to corneal transplantation. The cornea is the clear front part of the eye, and if it gets blurry, people have problems seeing, and you get corneal transplants from... So I looked it up. It happens to be that with corneal transplants, the donation can happen. You don't have to get into the brain death issue, because the coronation, if the donor has been kept cool after passing away, the tissue can recover for up to 8 to 12 hours. And then can be placed in a special solution before 24 hours, and then it can be used for up to 7 days. So it's a longer time frame than many other organ transplantations, so whatever it is. But the question is, let's suppose that in the context of corneal transplantation, you have leftover tissue, and you don't need it for the transplant. So what do you do with that tissue? So Tzitzit Ezra said, you have to bury it, because any parts of the human body that are sort of amputated, we think you have to bury. Mitzat anaf mitzvah, it's part of the mitzvah of burying people who passed away, is part of respect for the human body. First, because you're not allowed to get any benefit from such things. So in general, we have things that are Isurei Hana that are prohibited to get benefit from it, as we've seen on another occasion regarding Orla and Kilei HaKerem, a discussion of that, of what you have to do with it. So generally things that are asurim b'hana'a, you have to at least bury to make sure that nobody gets mistakenly gets benefit from it. And also from miniata nivul, you don't want to mistreat parts of the human body that have been removed, and therefore you're supposed to bury it. Now, you don't have to bury it for yourself. You can give it to a chevra kadisha. Chevra kadishas are burying people all the time. They can just put it in along with the rest of the stuff being buried. And when you have a question as to whether the person, so let's say you don't know who the donor was and you have leftover tissue, I actually saw on some website that one cornea can help two donors. It can help two people, I'm sorry, one donation can help two people restore the sight who have cornea problems. So if that's true, then there's maybe leftover stuff that you get from the transplant. And you know if it's a Jew or a non-Jew, so we think that we don't bury non-Jews among Jews, and therefore you should bury this material on the edge of a cemetery away from other Jews, but also not in a Jewish cemetery. Then he points out that Yabia Omer, Rav Yosef, who was a great friend of the Tzitzit, they were colleagues and contemporaries, they were not only contemporaries, but colleagues and friends, and they have very nice interactions every so often in their Tshuvot. And he also says that the obligation of the mitzvah of Kvura, of parts of the body of people who have passed away, applies to corneas, and the point is it applies even to a pachot mikazayit, even to less than a kezayit of material. So part, I think, the important point is the cornea that we're using is from a person who's passed away. If you have live donations and live things that come off, I think there's less of an issue because it's not the same situation. And then Tzitzit puts in square brackets. I put it in square brackets, but I think he puts it in square brackets, and I want to stress that these are one of those situations where it's not clear what his position would have been today and how time has gone on since then. This is a tshuva from 1981, and we're 35 years later, and you know, medical things change, and maybe we would have evaluated the situation differently. But he says, "Birsoni lahadgish she'ein lefarish dati laheter etzem hashtalat ayin v'meit yehudi." I'm not telling you that I think it's okay to transplant the cornea from a Jewish person who has passed away, because I think that those are things that there are many important isurim, they're problematic, the prohibitions that apply to this, and I've already discussed it in volume 14 of the Tzitzit Eliezer. And all I'm saying here is, if you're telling me that it's already been done, and nobody asked me a question, so what do they do, or they got a heter from somebody else who held that it was okay, what do they do with the material, and I'm telling you they have to bury it. It's not a topic today, but there was, in fact, I think, against even cornea transplantation, meaning when you have transplantation that has a problem with brain death, so you can have one set of problems with it, but I think he had problems with transplantation, even if that's not an issue. He thought the idea of being, he thought the problem of nivul hamet, of tampering with a person who's passed away was significant enough that he didn't think cornea transplantation allowed for us to do it anyway. Now, a similar kind of question, although not exactly the same question, is what about where you have somebody who's ill and they need to have their eye removed. So they remove the eye, and that's fine because that was a medical need. Are you required to bury it, or can you keep it or parts of it to show to medical students and have them help them learn about the eye and about how to treat the eye and things like that? So it seems like a valid medical purpose that you're using it for. It's not nivul hamed. It's not a mistreatment of those who have passed away. Are you allowed to do this? He says he thinks you are, because when we take things off of people who are alive, an eva ha-poresh min ha-chai, a part of the body that has been separated from a person who's living. So we all know Eiver Menachai from the prohibition that applies to Jews and non-Jews, that you can't eat or Eiver Menachai. But he's saying we're allowed to be mitnen, and we can get benefit from it, and therefore doctors can use it to learn with. But after they're finished learning with it, they have to make sure not to mistreat it, not to just throw it away. Right? You have to put it away someplace where it'll be separate from everything else, and then you have to bury it. Then it's preferable to bury it mamash, meaning in the ground, and he's already spoken about that in a previous volume, in volume 10, responsum number 25, chapter 8, and you can look for it there. So those are, that is the responsum to this eye doctors. But question number one was, somebody has eye problems, the doctor's required to reveal, and that could affect other people. Is the doctor required to reveal it? Answer was yes. Question number two was, are you allowed to, what do you do with the extra tissue from a corneal transplant? The answer was you have to bury it. It's part of a person who's passed away. Question number three was, when there are eyes that have been amputated or removed from somebody for medical reasons, are you allowed to use them for medical, he doesn't say research, but for medical training? And the answer is yes, you are. But when done with them, there too, you have to treat them with proper respect, and he thinks you have to bury them, in fact, bury them in the ground. At the end of, as a postscript, right, there's the man who writes Bishulei HaTshuva often, as a postscript, he says, you know, I gave you a previous tshuva, and this is the response that I mentioned at the beginning, which is, I think, his most famous response, and it's a little sad, because the man published 22 volumes of responses, as far as I could tell. And some of those volumes have small books in them, a book on visiting the sick, which is called, I think, Ramat Rachel, and a book on mourning those who passed away, which is called, I can't find it now, but he wrote a short book when his mother passed away, I think, on the laws of visiting the sick, and then when his father passed away, something like Nachok Liakov, but something like Liakov, and that was on Avelos issues, I think. So in any case, the point is he's a productive, and he wrote a lot on medical halacha, and he's a productive dayan about, you know, in the rabbinical courts, he's dealing with marriage issues often. He's producing huge amounts of Torah, and what people know him for is that he held you're allowed to abort a Tay-Sachs baby. Right? I remember mentioning to people that I was talking to, this, oh, he's the one who says you can abort a Tay-Sachs baby, oh, he's really, really good. And it's one of those things where you watch people judge people on knowing like a tiny bit of their work, and they use that as a reflection of their entire work. And as we've seen, there are situations where he's much more conservative on medical issues than other people are. And then you say, oh, I can't believe he would do that. And the answer is, he's a man, and he has an understanding of Torah. And that understanding of Torah leads him to make certain decisions. And that's where he comes to. So now he's coming to a discussion with this Bishulei Tshuva. He wants to mention that he previously had written about abortion with a Tay-Sachs baby. And part of the way in about Down syndrome was an issue as well. And I think Down syndrome, he wasn't so comfortable saying that you could abort it. I think he was hesitant to say that. Whereas I think Rav Shlomo Goren is known to be the one who said you could abort a Down syndrome baby. But he held you could certainly abort, he held you could abort a Tay-Sachs baby. You don't see Tay-Sachs and Down syndrome, but Down syndrome babies live a lot longer and have more meaningful lives in the sense of while they're not normal, they don't develop in the way that most other children do, so that's what we call normal, is what most children do, and they don't develop in that way, they do build lives, and they live, you know, there, I think, the better medicine gets, 40s, 50s, maybe even 60s, and they have some sense of life, so that's a much more complicated halakha in terms of being able to abort them, but with a Tay-Sachs baby, sadly, so sadly, and so tragically, the development stops at some point very early on, and then they necessarily pass away, and medical knowledge knows of no way to stop that. So that was where I think he felt comfortable permitting it. But part of the crux, or part of the foundation of that, was the opinion of the Rambam, which he claimed meant, I think others like Rav Moshe Feinstein disagreed. I think Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks of, I think in this case Rav Moshe Feinstein is the minority, but I think Rav Moshe Feinstein thought of abortion as actual murder because he thought the baby was a full life already. The fetus, the embryo, was a full life. The Tzitzit says that he understands the Rambam to mean that as long as the baby has not yet come out, it is not yet considered a full life, and therefore just killing it, right, aborting it, is not murder. It doesn't mean it's allowed, and there's a whole conversation that we're not going to have because that's not the topic of this tshuva, but once it's not murder, it lets us ignore or avoid certain definitions, certain problems that you would have about allowing a woman to abort the baby. So at the time that he had written that tshuva, it wasn't so obvious. It was a topic of conversation, and he took that position. Now he says, I've seen two previous gedolim from the previous generation who thought that the Rambam had held that way, and they found other Rambams that they thought, other comments in the Rambam they thought indicated that. So the first one was in Hilchot Ishaut, the Rambam wrote, Ha'isha calls much back in the time of the Rambam, the time of the Gemara, there was an assumption that women would do some kind of household work, and she was required to, and that was sort of an understanding and an accepted piece of the marital relationship. She'd do certain kinds of work, and she would maybe produce certain kinds of value for it, and she would get fed by her husband, who would be supporting her. So when a woman is pregnant, says the Rambam, we reduce the amount of work we expect of her, because today, again, I'm not saying this is what the halakha would be today. These are just understandings you had of how the marital relationships and the financial aspects of marital relationships worked back then. So she would work less because she was pregnant, therefore not feeling so well, and therefore she would take it easier, and she would get more food because she would be hungrier. So let's say they said, okay, this is the amount of food that a pregnant woman needs. I remember the first time my wife was pregnant, her doctor said to her, okay, now you need to know that you're eating for two, but one of them is this small, and you know, held up her fingers a tiny amount because the fetus at the early stages for sure is very small. So in any case, let's say they thought they'd given her enough extra food for her pregnancy, but she says she wants more, then she eats the more, whatever she wants. And the husband can't say to her, you can't eat, and the husband can't even say, I'm worried that by eating too much, you're going to kill the baby, right? It's going to cause an abortion. Today, I don't think we think that anyway, but let's say the husband comes up with that idea. Let's even say that for the purpose of this conversation, that medical knowledge of the time agrees with him. that they are worried that her eating a certain amount would cause the baby to abort. Whether or not that's true, whether or not it was true then, if it's the medical knowledge of the time, then you deal with the medical knowledge of your time, and that's what you have to live with. So the Rambam says, doesn't matter, she gets to eat the more, she'tsa'ar gufa kodem. That her pain, her hunger, and her feeling that she needs the food and she wants the food, that takes precedence. So people were astounded that the Rambam could write that. How could you think that the fact that her longings for food and her feelings that she's not eating enough would take precedence over the death of the baby, right? So if it's where she's nursing the baby, that's really a strong question. And that's the way people understood it for whatever reason. They understood the Rambam to include a nursing mother in there. It's really odd to think that she would have the right, you know, let's say, you know, the doctor told her, listen, your baby has an allergy to, I don't know, broccoli. And if you eat broccoli, you're causing the baby to go into anaphylactic shock. So I don't think anybody would think that she has the right to just do it because she says, well, I like broccoli. The idea that she could do that with a nurse, with a baby that she's nursing, unimaginable. So the Haggad Moharim, who wrote a commentary on the Gra, but this is the Acharon that he was referring to, he says, no, he thinks that the Rambam is not talking about a nursing mother, he's talking about a pregnant mother. So a pregnant mother, he says, that would be, the Rambam thinks that the baby isn't yet a full life, and since the baby's not a full life, and he tries to explain how he gets it from the words, but since the baby's not a full life, what bothers her takes precedence. So that's a fascinating claim by the Morim, which I'm not sure we follow completely al halacha, but this idea, these understand the Rambam to mean that while she's pregnant, if she really feels that she needs something or she wants something, even if people tell her it's dangerous to the baby, she can choose to do it, and the husband can't stop it because her comfort takes precedence over the baby. I'm not telling you whether that's the way we passing today and how we passing today, but this is just pointing out that supports his claim that here's another person who held, the Rambam held, that the baby, the embryo, the fetus, until it comes out, is not a full life in halacha, and therefore changes our halachic dealings with it. So that's the first of two examples. The other example, I didn't ask him to love so much, and we're running out of time, so I'll leave it. But I'll just remember one last thing that he says. If you look into Tezer in the 8th volume in Lamed Zayin, Rosh Shlomo Kluger had also pointed out that a baby of a fetus, an embryo, doesn't have a chazaka dechiyuta, and therefore he held that her tsa'ar, her pain, takes precedence over it. Where you apply that, where you don't apply that is an interesting question, but that would be another example where the baby is not as full of life, the fetus, the embryo, is not as full of life as the mother's, and therefore the mother's needs and rights take precedence not only where her life is threatened, but even at a much lower level, her needs can take precedence over what we see as the baby's needs. So that is a responsible day for the 13th of Adar. Today's are telling us about doctors, eye doctors, issues that come up, as well as referring us back again to some of the discussion about abortion that he had before. Have a great day.